From the Radio Ranch in the heart of Liberty, Texas, it's the Bombastic Blogcast for Wednesday, February 19th, 2025. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
Yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, the kid with the patriotic red, white, and blue eyes, and one heck of a nice guy. Ask anybody, they'll tell you. We need to get things properly launched for this big blogcast with
the Daily Denogram.
You got it. Words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. And today's Denogram comes to us from the late, great Vince Lombardi, perhaps one of the greatest football coaches to ever have lived. He said, "The greatest strength a champion can hold is humility." And suddenly I'm reminded of Muhammad Ali, who said, "I am the greatest."
Put that one on the psycho list.
Let's move along now with the so-called educational part of this big blogcast.
Twisted History.
This is it.
Gather round, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
Oh, boy.
Some cool, some not so cool.
Exciting.
Just the same. You need to know your Twisted History.
Really?
You might be quizzed.
Yeah. Surely it's going to happen. All right, kids, it was on this day in 1963, the publication of Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique reawakened the feminist movement in the United States as women's organizations and consciousness-raising groups spread, all while the miniskirt and hot pants became the latest fashion craze. I guess a little yin versus yang there, huh? And it was on this day in 2002, NASA's Mars Odyssey space probe began to map the surface of Mars using its thermal emission imaging system. How exciting! Of course, all of this was being done under the assumption that one day they would send a crew to Mars. And then it was around that time that a couple of movies were released out of Hollywood depicting an astronaut who gets stranded on Mars. Coincidence? You be the judge.
Isn't it delightful?
There's a fellow who goes by the byline of Joshua C., who writes for WLT Report. And just about every day, he's got something fascinating. I stumbled across this. He says the former deputy assistant director for the FBI's counterintelligence division just wiped his ex account clean. Now, this is somebody you remember. He's talking about Peter Stroke. Remember him? And he basically admitted under oath back in 2018 that the entire seventh floor brass of the FBI were guilty of sedition in their active attempts to undermine President Trump's presidency. And when he made that admission, of course, he was part of that team. And so Joshua writes, "It's also interesting to note that none of those people, including Stroke, were recipients of a Biden pardon. Is that the definition of being hung out to dry?" Well, it seems it would be. And anyhow, if you recall some of the video testimony in front of a congressional committee, Stroke threw out the whole guilty lot, just basically threw them under the bus. And of course, there's his infamous text messages between the FBI lawyer, Lisa Page, with whom he was having a relationship. So Peter and Page were engaged in trying to bring down a presidency during the day and were lovers by night. So, you know, not sure which mental image sickens you the most, but both were inappropriate and illegal in more ways than one. But when you're part of the deep state, the legality of something really is immaterial. Doesn't mean anything. Also, interestingly, Kash Patel, who's likely to be confirmed as director of the FBI, answered during his confirmation hearing that the American people deserve to know what happened to Peter Stroke and Lisa Page. And the $1.5 million... Peter Stroke apparently received from the DOJ after he sued them for wrongful termination. Oh, I'll tell you what, those Democrats, those lefties, they are so skillful when it comes to courtrooms. So the fact that this guy just wiped his ex account just before Kash Patel gets the keys to the kingdom with a promise to come after those who weaponize the FBI. You know, Kash Patel has promised that, and he's going to do it. So when you consider this, stroke wiping his ex account before Kash Patel takes the keys to the office, it's very telling. Very telling. So, Sean Ryan, who has a podcast called The Sean Ryan Show, he posted on X. He said, former FBI officials Peter Stroke and Lisa Page have settled with the Justice Department over alleged privacy rights violations after the release of their disparaging text messages leveraged by former President Trump to challenge the Russia investigation during his presidency. So not only did Peter Stroke get away with his subversive plan to bring down a president, but he made off with $1.2 million from the DOJ because he argued that his subversive texts were protected political speech. And you see that, and you just can't help but think, boy, this kid is good. And here's the way ABC News reported on it. Former FBI agent Pete Stroke, who was fired from the Bureau in 2018 after his disparaging text messages about Donald Trump were made public, has reached a settlement with the Justice Department over his claims that his privacy rights were violated, according to his lawyers. I mean, isn't this rich? This guy is engaged in criminal activity, as well as activity that runs counter to FBI policy. And he sues us, the taxpayers, and wins. So according to Stroke's lawyers, the U.S. government had agreed to pay Stroke $1.2 million. In his 2019 lawsuit, Stroke and his lawyers argued that the FBI and DOJ unlawfully disclosed his private text messages disparaging Trump before and after the 2016 presidential election, including the time frame during which Stroke helped lead the agency's investigation into former Secretary of State Clinton, Hillary Clinton's private email server and Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. And the lawsuit argued that the FBI fired Special Agent Stroke because of his protected political speech in violation of his rights under the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. Yeah, I guess he knew some good lawyers. So Joshua C. writes, I'm surprised Peter Stroke is able to satisfy himself by simply deleting his ex content. Good point. So, as President Trump pointed out in a 2020 speech, if James Comey had not been fired, Peter Stroke and Lisa Page would have never been found out. So you have to wonder, what would have happened if that were the case? So what's our national debt right now? Something like $35 to $37 trillion? We are in a deep hole. Everybody knows that. And yet, over the years, we have shoveled I don't know how many billions upon billions of dollars to foreign governments, foreign countries, for their little skirmishes and police actions and wars and what have you. Not to mention all the stuff that's been uncovered by DOGE in that agency known as USAID, USAID. And, you know, for Sesame Street shows for Iraq, transgender training and DEI initiatives in Africa. I mean, come on. So President Trump lately has been reminding me of my dad. Nobody could move faster than my father stamping out a burning dollar bill, which is understandable because my father grew up in the Great Depression. And when you go through something like that, you just never forget it. I mean, my dad ended up doing very well for himself in life and, you know, financially. And his total assets at the time of my dad's passing were pretty generous. My mom was set for life. And when she passed away, there was a bunch of money in the estate. So dad ended up doing real well. But for his entire life, up until the last, maybe 10, 15 years of his life, He always was so tight with money. Well, this is the way Donald Trump is being with our money lately, and I like this. So if we allegedly owe $35 trillion in debt to other people in other countries, why don't we start calling in some chips of our own? Well, this is what Trump is doing. He wants a deal from Zelensky over there in Ukraine. He wants a deal where we get some rare earth metals. And this was actually a proposal that was put forth by U.S. Treasury Secretary Bessent. And Zelensky doesn't want anything to do with that. Right now, I'm afraid Zelensky is suffering from a little disease known as arrogance. Frankly, I would support a regime change. Get rid of Zelensky. This guy's not doing the job. But anyhow, when it comes to this money that Donald Trump feels is owed us, $350 billion from Ukraine, I'm solidly behind this. How we get the money, whether it's in rare earth minerals or we get it in cash, doesn't matter to me. So the other day, President Trump was there in the Oval Office addressing the press, and one reporter asked, would you support Zelensky's ceding territory or exchanging territory in any agreement to end the war?
Well, he's going to have to do what he has to do, but, you know, his poll numbers aren't particularly great. To put it mildly, he's got a country where, you know, it's been savaged and attacked. And he's got an army that's been very, very brave, actually, despite the fact that, you know, we've given him, in my opinion, $350 billion. That's what the real number is. You don't hear that number. And Europe has given, in my opinion, $100 billion. And they've done it in the form of a loan. And I have a Secretary of Treasury right now who's actually quite brave. He's over in Ukraine on a train, and there's a lot of things happening around that train that aren't so good. And he's going there to get a document done where we're going to be assured that we're going to, in some form, get this money back, because we're putting up far more money than Europe, and Europe is in far more danger than we are. We have an ocean in between. Europe has nothing in between. So you know what they have in between? They have Ukraine in between. So wait a minute. So, as you know, Europe is putting up money, and they're getting it in the form of a loan. And the United States under Biden didn't do loans. They just handed money every time somebody walked in from Ukraine. They just handed them money foolishly. This should have never happened. It should have never started. And once it did, other things should have happened. Other things should have taken place. So we're getting security on our money. We're going to have it secured by rare earth, and they have oil and gas, and they have a lot of other things, and we're asking for security in our money. They've agreed to it. Ukraine has agreed to it.
Does that mean you are not sending any more aid to Ukraine?
No, we are, but we want it secured, and the money is going to be secured.
So the way the Trump administration, this new one, this second term started out, the focus was on money. Where is it? Where is it going? Who's got it? How do we get it back? And this is going to be a theme, I think, for the entire four-year term. You know, even left-leaning ChatGPT admitted that we've got to get something back from Ukraine for all this aid that we've sent them. And let me quote them. This is what ChatGPT wrote. The financial aid the United States has been providing to Ukraine in recent years is a mix of both direct budgetary support and military assistance, rather than being structured as loans that need to be repaid. Now, according to the U.S. Agency for International Development, you know, our friends over at USAID, the U.S. has provided billions in direct budgetary support to help Ukraine manage the acute budget deficit caused by the conflict, including funds to keep basic government services running and support for emergency responders. This assistance is designed to help the government of Ukraine withstand economic, social, and political pressures and doesn't need to be repaid. In addition to budgetary support, a significant portion of U.S. aid has been allocated to military and security assistance to help Ukraine defend its sovereignty and territorial integrity. This includes funding for the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which pays for training, weapons, and other military assistance, as well as funds to replenish U.S. weapons sent to Ukraine, and for the Foreign Military Financing Program, enabling Ukraine to purchase new military equipment from the U.S. Overall, the aid is part of the U.S.'s commitment to support Ukraine in the face of aggression, with the aim of ensuring the country's stability and security. The funding for humanitarian and economic aid is provided with the understanding that it's a grant to support Ukraine's immediate needs and long-term recovery rather than a loan to be repaid. Wow. So the financial assistance provided by the United States to Ukraine, especially in the context of the recent aggression, has largely been structured as grants rather than loans. So this means that these funds, including direct budgetary support and military aid, don't need to be paid back by Ukraine. The aid is intended to help the country address its immediate needs. You know, support its government functions, bolster its defense capabilities, that sort of thing. For instance, the U.S. Agency for International Development, again, our friends at USAID, has provided substantial direct budgetary support to Ukraine aimed at alleviating the country's budget deficit caused by the conflict and ensuring the continuity of essential government services. Now, this kind of support, it is designed to be non-repayable and is given to help Ukraine withstand economic, social, and political pressures resulting from the conflict. And this is a bag that we Americans have gotten ourselves into repeatedly ever since the end of World War II. Just give the money, give the money, give the money, help these countries. And then no thought of what do we get in return. Now, for instance, as the case with Japan, we gave a lot of money to Japan to help them rebuild. They needed to rebuild. And in the few short years between 1945, the end of World War II, when we got the Japanese surrender, and 1958, what did we do? Did we get paid back by Japan for any of this help that we gave? No. Japan ended up making steel cheaper than we could make it. It's like I mentioned the other day. They would import iron ore from Hibbing, Minnesota, ship it to Tokyo, turn it into steel, and send the steel back to us cheaper than we could make it ourselves here in the States. There's something wrong with that system. So when you look at our national debt of what, $35, $37 trillion, is it any wonder? As I've mentioned on a number of occasions, Donald Trump is moving so quickly, the news media has a difficult time keeping up with him. But something that's very important here, his job approval rating has climbed to 55%, according to a new poll that was released over the weekend. The Napolitan News and RMG Research Survey found that 55% of registered voters approve of Trump's performance, while 43% disapprove. Now, the national poll was conducted among 3,000 registered voters from February 10th to 14th. So basically, this was last week, with a margin of error of 1.8%. Now, a separate poll released on Thursday showed a lower approval rating for Trump at 48%. And meanwhile, a pretty important shift is taking place in how major corporations approach and fund diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Well, President Trump accelerated this transition last month by signing an executive order eliminating DEI policies and staff within the federal government and extending the ban to federal contractors. Now, some private companies had already begun scaling back DEI initiatives before Trump took office. So, following his directive, several companies have started retreating from their DEI commitments, at least symbolically. Even if substantive internal changes remain limited, the overall picture of this DEI thing is it's in decline. For instance, Costco had resisted pressure, pushing back against the Trump administration's directive, while other major corporations, including Amazon, Walmart, Target, and Meta, have announced a retreat from DEI initiatives. Now, in I don't know how many cases, but in several cases, these companies will say that they have retreated from their DEI policies, and yet they rename them, they change the paperwork, they change the letterhead to mask the idea that they're engaged in DEI practices, but still they continue. So there's a lot of that going on. But meanwhile, companies like a Wisconsin-based financial services firm, Fiserv, have yet to make any public changes to their DEI policies. And businesses that choose to maintain DEI-driven hiring practices face really an uncertain legal landscape. Because this is especially relevant for companies like Fiserv, which receives hundreds of millions of dollars in government contracts. Currently, Fiserv's website still has a diversity and inclusion page, which says the company is committed to promoting diversity and inclusion across all levels of the organization, in our communities, and throughout our industry. It also says that the company partners with people and organizations around the world to advance their DEI efforts and create opportunities for their employees, entrepreneurs around the world, and the next generation of innovators. You know, all of that PR stuff. I call it fluff. Anyhow, the company's DEI page features a careers section that talks about engaging diverse talent and holding events to connect with diverse candidates. And of course, critics of DEI initiatives argue that they promote discrimination against white men and Asians, prioritizing hiring and promotions based on race and sexual orientation rather than merit. And when you want to see the result of that, just look back at the Biden administration. I mean, what a freak show that was. So a pivotal moment in the pushback against DEI occurred during the Biden administration when the Supreme Court struck down long-standing affirmative action policies at American universities, highlighting instances of discrimination against white and Asian Americans. You see, the answer to discrimination is not further discrimination. It's like I've said for years, you can't fight racism with racism. So Trump's election has really reinforced this legal shift, setting boundaries that I think are a little more clear on how race and gender can be considered in hiring, promotions, workplace policies, that kind of stuff. Now, Trump's anti-DEI order noted in part, in the private sector, many corporations and universities use DEI as an excuse for biased and unlawful employment practices and illegal admissions preferences, ignoring the fact that DEI's foundational rhetoric and ideas foster intergroup hostility and authoritarianism, which is true. And the statement goes on to say that billions of dollars are spent annually on DEI, but rather than reducing bias and promoting inclusion, DEI creates and then amplifies prejudicial hostility and exacerbates interpersonal conflict. DEI has become increasingly controversial as activists use the moniker to advance every liberal policy on race and gender, often at taxpayer expense. In the federal government, DEI had become widespread and infiltrated into every part of governance, from racial quotas for promotions at the Pentagon to driving healthcare research at the National Institutes of Health. At private companies, DEI policies guided investment decisions via ESG. You remember that, don't you? Environmental, social, governance, as well as personnel decisions with racial quotas for company boardrooms. Those ideas are out of favor with the Trump administration. Some of the companies resisting the shift from DEI could face legal action. Let's hope they do, because DEI is nothing but racism, further racism. In fact, basically, it would be fair to say that DEI is taking us all the way back to the pre-civil rights days. It's teaching non-whites. This is just a sweeping analysis of what DEI does. It teaches non-whites that whites are evil. Now, prove me wrong. In an administrative incident that took place over the weekend, the Social Security Administration's acting commissioner reportedly resigned after a dispute with DOGE over the Elon Musk-headed group's efforts to access sensitive government records. Now, Michelle King, a career federal worker, I want to emphasize that, a career federal worker who had been with the Social Security Administration since 1994, quit over the DOGE disagreement back on Saturday and was replaced by Leland Dudek. And this is according to a story in the Washington Post. Now, Dudek has been supportive of DOGE's efforts to root out waste, fraud, and abuse in the federal government. He's going to serve as acting commissioner of the Social Security Administration until President Trump's pick to lead the agency, Frank Bisignano, is confirmed by the Senate. So, this is all taking, its orderly place in the government way of doing things. Now, DOGE staffers embedded at Social Security reportedly sought access to sensitive files in the same manner that they have at other federal agencies, you know, like the Treasury Department, since Trump established this unit, DOGE. Now, Social Security, which manages Social Security payments for more than 70 million Americans, holds troves of personal data. Now, the agency has a list of every Social Security number that's ever been issued, as well as work and pay history and banking information for millions of Americans. And they keep the medical records of Americans who've applied for disability benefits. And at this point, it's unclear what specific information was being sought by DOGE that led to King's resignation. But I'm trying to remember the number of people over the age of 100 years old who are still getting Social Security checks. Where's that money going? I mean, yeah, it's going to dead people, but where does it go from that point on? So, yeah, there's a lot of cleanup necessary on that aisle known as Social Security. To the Comedy Corner with Mike Siegel.
I don't know. After 20 years of bad relationships, I'm starting to think I might be part of the problem. Nah. That's just the therapy talking. My ex told me I had intimacy issues. As if that's any of her business. Tough. I'm starting to date. As I get older, I have to date people who already had kids, which is that's a tough one. You can't rush that. You can't meet those kids too early. You know, I had this woman, it was like two dates, and she already said, hey, she had two little boys, and she went, I'm going to take the kids to the carnival this weekend. You want to go? I was like, wow. No. Sounds awful. I mean, I'm not anti-kid, but you know, who am I to these kids? I'm just some guy. They don't know me. I can't discipline them if they're acting up at the carnival. Hey, get down from there. You're going to get hurt. You're not my dad. You know what? You're right. Go ahead. Stand up in the tilt-a-whirl. I want to see how this goes. I'm kind of curious myself to see how this is going to play out. I've dated all types. Went out with a vegan, and that was once, I think. Couldn't figure out what they could eat or not. I couldn't. As far as I could tell, a vegan could have like chickpeas and cotton. That was it. Could have some hummus and wash it down with a tube sock or something. All my friends have kids, and you feel left out at parties. You know, when they're always, everybody's got their phones out showing photos of their kids, you know. So if you feel left out at those points, just do what I do and just show them photos of single person stuff that they can't do anymore. And just go, ooh, look, this is me sleeping in on the weekend. Yeah, what do you think? Oh, this is me in my white carpet. Yeah. Ooh, this is my favorite one. This is me leaving a bad relationship and still keeping my house.
Get on out there and make it the best day possible. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's bombastic blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And you be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
You mean that's it?
See you tomorrow, G-Man.